Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program Number 629, titled It's Not Easy Being Green, Part 2, Ecofascism. This is being recorded on March 16th of the year 2008. We're going to jump right in where we left off at the end of Side 1. We've been reading from a book which I emphatically recommend to listeners. If some of the things that I'm saying are not quite clear to people, if it seems a little highbrow, and it probably does, by all means get the book. The book is a very small one. It's called Ecofascism, Lessons from the German Experience. It's co-authored by Janet Biehl, B-I-E-H-L, and Peter Staudenmaier, S-T-A-U-D-E-N-M-A-I-E-R, both of whom have experience with the green movements on both sides of the Atlantic. And it is published in softcover by the AK Press, P.O. Box 40682, San Francisco, California, 94140-0682. It also has an address in Edinburgh, Scotland. We left off in Side 2, talking about the Wandervogel, or wandering birds, kind of right-wing hippies as they were described. They were part of the blood-and-soil mystified ecological movement, which ultimately gave rise to the green wing of the Nazi Party. Now, even though some of the causes that and some of the particular stances that are advocated by these fascist greens will resonate sympathetically with some members of the audience, and indeed there are some aspects of it that I agree with, one should be very, very clear about understanding that this is the wrong way to use some right things. It's like fire. You can use it to warm yourself, you can use it to cook food, or you can use it as an instrument of terrible destruction. It's up to you. Or water. You can use water to put out a fire, you can use water to water a garden or to quench your thirst, or you can use it for waterboarding. It's up to you. So let's plunge right back into the book Ecofascism, Lessons from the German Experience. And again, please get the book. I have no connection whatsoever with either author or the publisher. Get no money from it, but it's an important book, and I recommend it. We're going to plunge right in talking about the pre-Nazi antecedents of the Green Wing of the Nazi Party that we spoke about last week in For the Record 628. Talking about the Wandervogel, most of whom became Nazis, the authors write, "The attraction such perspectives exercised on idealistic youth is clear. The enormity of the crisis seemed to enjoin a total rejection of its apparent causes. It is in the specific form of this rejection that the danger lies. Here, the work of several more theoretical minds from that period is instructive. The philosopher Ludwig Klages, K-L-A-G-E-S, profoundly influenced the youth movement and particularly shaped their ecological consciousness. He authored a tremendously important essay titled Man and Earth, unquote, for the legendary Meissner gathering of the Wandervogel in 1913. An extraordinarily poignant text and the best known of all of Klages' work, it is not only, quote, one of the very greatest manifestos of the radical eco-pacifist movement in Germany, unquote, but also a classic example of the seductive terminology of reactionary ecology. Man and Earth anticipated just about all of the themes of the contemporary ecology movement. It decried the accelerating extinction of species, disturbance of global ecosystematic balance, deforestation, destruction of aboriginal peoples and of wild habitats, urban sprawl, and the increasing alienation of people from nature. In emphatic terms, it disparaged Christianity, capitalism, economic utilitarianism, hyper-consumption, and the ideology of progress, unquote. It even condemned the environmental destructiveness of rampant tourism and the slaughter of whales, and displayed a clear recognition of the planet as an ecological totality. And all of this in 1913. And again, all of that from saving the whales to the disturbance of global ecosystemic balance, deforestation, themes very much in keeping with the ecology movement of today and things that I agree with. But watch how this plays out. And that's one of the things that makes this so seductive. And again, looking at the fascist element in the green movement and today and how that's hooking up with elements of the 911 truth movement and some really reactionary political elements. This should hopefully alert people to begin sniffing the air very carefully when around elements like this. Of Klages and his work, the authors write, "It may come as a surprise, then, to learn that Clausius was throughout his life politically arch-conservative and a venomous anti-Semite. One historian labels him a Völkisch fanatic, and another considers him simply an intellectual pacemaker for the Third Reich, unquote, who paved the way for fascist philosophy in many important respects, unquote. In Man and Earth, a genuine outrage at the devastation of the natural environment is coupled with a political subtext of cultural despair. Clausius' diagnosis of the ills of modern society, for all its declamations about capitalism, always returns to a single culprit, Geist, or spirit. His idiosyncratic use of this term, which means mind or intellect, was meant to denounce not only hyper-rationalism or instrumental reason, but rational thought itself. Such a wholesale indictment of reason cannot help but savage political implications. It forecloses any chance of rationally reconstructing society's relationship with nature and justifies the most brutal authoritarianism. But the lessons of Clausius' life and work have been hard for ecologists to learn. In 1980, Man and Earth was republished as an esteemed and seminal treatise to accompany the birth of the German Greens. And we talked about the German Greens, the murder of Petra Kelly by her Nazi significant other, former two-star general in the Bundeswehr, last week. And that, again, right in the period when the Green Party was metamorphosing for the peaceful rationale for allowing German reunification on the part of the Soviets, to the Volksgruppe und Rechte advocate of Yugoslavian fragmentation, and the resulting result, which was the first major land war in Europe since the end of World War II. Talking about how the von der Vogel, the youth movement, in turn helped to spur the birth of the Green movement, the Green wing of the Nazi Party, and again, large numbers of the von der Vogel were incorporated into the early Nazi movement. In addition to the youth movement and proto-fascist philosophies, there were, of course, practical efforts at protecting natural habitats during the Weimar period. Many of these projects were profoundly implicated in the ideology which culminated in the victory of blood and soil, unquote. A 1923 recruitment pitch for a woodlands preservation outfit gives a sense of the environmental rhetoric of the time. Quote, "In every German breast, the German forest quivers with its caverns and ravines, crags and boulders, waters and winds, legends and fairy tales, with its songs and its melodies, and awakens a powerful yearning and a longing for home. In all German souls, the German forest lives and weaves with its depth and breadth, its stillness and strength, its might and dignity, its riches and its beauty. It is the source of German inwardness, of the German soul, of German freedom. Therefore, protect and care for the German forest for the sake of the elders and the youth, and join the new German League for the Protection and Consecration of the German Forest," unquote. The mantra-like repetition of the word German, unquote, and the mystical depiction of the sacred forest fused together once again nationalism and naturalism. This intertwinement took on a grisly significance with the collapse of the Weimar Republic. For alongside such relatively innocuous conservation groups, another organization was growing which offered these ideas as a hospitable home, the National Socialist German Workers' Party, known by its acronym NSDAP. Drawing on the heritage of Arndt, Riehl, and Haeckel, and others, all of whom were honored between 1933 and 1945 as forebearers of triumphant National Socialism, the Nazi movement's incorporation of environmentalist themes was a crucial factor in its rise to popularity and state power. The reactionary ecological ideas whose outlines are sketched above exerted a powerful and lasting influence on many of the central figures in the NSDAP. Weimar culture, after all, was fairly awash in such theories, but the Nazis gave them a peculiar inflection. The National Socialist religion of nature, as one historian has described it, was a volatile admixture of primeval Teutonic nature mysticism, pseudo-scientific ecology, irrationalist anti-humanism, and a mythology of racial salvation through a return to the land. Its predominant themes were natural order, organicist holism, and denigration of humanity. Quote, Throughout the writings not only of Hitler but of most Nazi ideologues, one can discern a fundamental deprecation of humans vis-à-vis nature, and as a logical corollary to this, an attack upon human efforts to master nature, unquote. Quoting a Nazi educator, the same source continues, "Anthropocentric views in general had to be rejected. They would be valid only, quote, if it is assumed that nature has been created only for man. We decisively reject this attitude. According to our conception of nature, man is a link in the living chain of nature, just as any other organism," unquote. Such arguments have a chilling currency within contemporary ecological discourse. The key to social ecological harmony is ascertaining, quote, the eternal laws of nature's processes, that a quote from Hitler, and organizing society to correspond to them. The Führer was particularly fond of stressing, quote, the helplessness of humankind in the face of nature's everlasting law, unquote. Echoing Haeckel and the monists, Mein Kampf announces, quote, when people attempt to rebel against the iron logic of nature, they come into conflict with the very same principles to which they owe their existence as human beings. Their actions against nature must lead to their own downfall. And to give people an idea of how some of the most heinous Nazis exhibited some aspects of pro-ecology philosophy that will resonate with many people, and to give people an idea of how seductive this can be, skipping down, such musings, it must be stressed, were not mere rhetoric. They reflected firmly held beliefs and indeed practices at the very top of the Nazi hierarchy, which are today conventionally associated with ecological attitudes. Both Hitler himself and Himmler, head of the SS, were strict vegetarians and animal lovers, attracted to nature mysticism and homeopathic cures, and staunchly opposed to vivisection and cruelty to animals. Himmler even established experimental organic farms to grow herbs for SS medicinal purposes. And Hitler, at times, could sound like a veritable green utopian discussing authoritatively and in detail various renewable energy sources, including environmentally appropriate hydropower and producing natural gas from sludge as alternatives to coal, and declaring, quote, water, winds, and tides, unquote, as the energy path of the future. And again, the authors point out that the fact that some of these are good ideas should not lead people to revise their views of Nazism, but rather to understand how this can be used as a rationale for, among other things, exterminating large numbers of people. And again, we talked at greater length and in greater detail last week about the Green Movement within the Nazi Party. And what we're going to look at next concerns some of the ways in which the contemporary Green Movement and the Green Party in Germany in particular have incorporated some of the eco-fascism of the pre-Nazi von der Vogel and German ecology movement, and also the green wing of the Nazi Party itself. We're going to talk now about how Rudolf Steiner's anthroposophy philosophy have been incorporated by elements of the Greens, and I can only recommend to people that they get a hold of the book to flesh out their understanding of Rudolf Steiner and how anthroposophy fits into this. But we're going to take note of the fact that, among other institutions, the Siemens and Bertelsmann corporations, both of them German core corporations, and both of them therefore inevitably governed by the Bormann Capital Network, the economic component of a Third Reich going underground, about which I speak so often, and about which listeners can inform themselves by downloading the remarkable book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, by the heroic Paul Mann. It's available for download for free on the Spitfire website. Bertelsmann, of course, the largest English language publisher, also deeply involved in music. Bertelsmann was the publisher for the SS in World War II. Heinrich Mohn, its patron, was a member of the SS, and Dirk Bovendam, their house historian, has published numerous books blaming World War II on Jewish control of the news media, Jewish control of Hollywood, and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the most recently published of those titles in 1998, and he's the official house historian of the largest English language publisher and also a company that is financing anthroposophy. of the anthroposophical ideas and how they are incorporated into the green Nazi philosophy, we read, "Anthroposophical ideas are eminently usable by eco-fascists today, and there is a strong right wing within the anthroposophists that is closely connected with the ultra-right." Author Günter Bartsch is an anthroposophist who is also a national revolutionary of the Solidarist variety, the author of an adulatory 1989 biography of brown shirt leader Otto Strasser. He attempts in his publications to synthesize ecological themes based on Steiner's ideas with Strasser's political ideas. It should be noted that anthroposophy is also well-funded by huge multinational corporations like Siemens and Bertelsmann. Next, the authors talk about Werner Georg Haverbeck, who was an actual veteran of the early Nazi party, of the entire Nazi period. In fact, he was a veteran of the Beer Hall Putsch, as was Green pioneer August Hausleiter, whom we looked at last week. And take note of Haverbeck and his continuity of activism from the early Nazi period of the 20s, right on up through the contemporary period. And he, in turn, is one of the people involved with something called the World League for the Protection of Life, or WSL, which is a very well-funded, albeit numerically small, reactionary environmental organization in the contemporary Federal Republic of Germany. The authors write, "Among the ultra-right adherents of anthroposophy today are officials of the World League for the Protection of Life, or WSL, a small but influential and very wealthy environmental organization in the Federal Republic. The garden at its educational center is cultivated according to biodynamic methods, and visitors are served organic refreshments. Yet this organization was founded in 1958 by former members of the National Socialist Party, or Nazi Party, and today it links protection of life, that is, right-to-life themes, and the environment with racism and a revival of folkish ideology. The life it is most interested in protecting is, of course, German life. Thus, the WSL is rabidly anti-abortion, believing that German women should be devoted to giving birth to Aryan," unquote, babies. The spiritual leader of the WSL and its key figure for most of its history has been Werner Georg Haverbeck. Born in 1909, Haverbeck became an active Nazi at an early age. It should be recalled that Nazism was largely a youth movement, so that members like Haverbeck are still alive. Haverbeck joined the SA in 1928 and from 1929 to 1932 was a member of the Reich Administration for the National Socialist Student League, Reichsleitung der NSDAP Studentschaft, and a leader of the Reich Youth Leadership of the Hitler Youth, and I'm not even going to attempt that German title. Continuing, he served as a leading official of the Strength Through Joy organization, which controlled recreational activities under the Third Reich. In 1933, Rudolf Hess saw to it that Haverbeck's passport was stamped, "This man is not to be arrested," unquote. He survived the Ernst Röhm purge to help organize the Nuremberg Party Congress and join Hess's staff. It was Hess who converted him to anthroposophy. During the war, he conducted radio propaganda in Denmark and worked in South America. By the end of the war, he was an officer. After the Allies rudely aborted Haverbeck's many efforts on behalf of the Third Reich, he contented himself for a time working as a pastor for the anthroposophical Christian community. He founded an educational center called the Collegium Humanum in 1963, where today eco-fascist, esoteric, folkish, anthroposophist, neo-pagan, and primitivist groups meet and hold workshops. He co-founded the WSL and served as its president from 1974 to 1982. In 1981, he was a signatory of the notorious Heidelberg Manifesto, a document drawn up by a group of professors to warn the German people of the dangers that immigration posed to them. Its first draft began, quote, "With grave concern, we observe the subversion of the German people through the influx of many millions of foreigners and their families, the foreignization of our language, our culture, and our nationhood. Already, many Germans have become foreigners in their own districts and workplaces, and thus, in their own Heimat." By the way, Heimat literally translates homeland, but it's a sort of a mystical blood and soil concept. Continuing, Routine as this language may sound now, when opposition to immigration in the Federal Republic is much more tolerated and neo-fascists pander to it relentlessly, the manifesto had to be toned down at the time, 1981, because of the public outcry it raised. In accordance with anthroposophical root race beliefs, Haverbeck is notable for propounding the thesis that the two world wars in this century in fact constituted a 30 years war waged by foreign aggressors against the German people and their spiritual life. Apparently, German spiritual life stood in the way of, quote, the strivings for world domination by the Anglo-Saxon race, unquote, behind which lay the intensive image of a call to world dominance like the old Jewish consciousness, unquote. Indeed, Haverbeck maintains the two world wars amounted to a conspiracy against the German people and spiritual life. It is an historical lie that the Nazis ran mass murder camps, unquote, argues Haverbeck, and is actually enemy propaganda, unquote. It was Russia that was the aggressor in the Second World War. And that again from one of the figures on the contemporary green scene in Germany. We're going to turn next to another of the eco-fascists in contemporary Germany, someone who has drawn on the political and cultural and philosophical trends of the green wing of the Nazi movement, its antecedents such as the Wandervogel in Weimar and pre-Weimar Germany, and is in many ways recapitulating eco-fascism and some of the key features of the green wing of the Nazi Party within the contemporary green movement. And people who are involved with ecological causes should be attuned to these dangers. Rudolf Barrow, B-A-H-R-O, the author's right. If fascists are using ecological themes to update their racial and nationalist aims, other thinkers are developing an ecological spiritualism along New Age lines that bears no small resemblance to the Völkisch Germanic spirituality of the 1920s. Indeed, quote, a great part of the literature about close-to-nature spirituality that the alternative scene is reading is permeated with reactionary, Völkisch, or even National Socialist content, writes Ditfurth. We find, again quoting, we find neo-fascist and ultra-right positions not only in the various political and even ecological groups, but also in neo-pagan, esoteric, and occult circles, unquote. Perhaps the most prominent figure in this connection is Rudolf Barrow. Many German new social movement circles previously accepted Barrow as a social theorist contributing to a socialism with a human face, unquote, and continue to regard him as part of the independent left. Leftist periodicals publish uncritical interviews with him. In the Anglo-American world, too, many radical ecologists can still consider Barrow as representing something leftist, unquote. Yet Barrow no longer considers himself a leftist. Indeed, he is a vehement critic of the left and of comrades without fatherland, unquote. In fact, as anti-fascist researcher Roger Niedenfuhr argues, since the mid-1980s, Barrow has been contributing to the development of a spiritual fascism, unquote, that has the effect of rehabilitating National Socialism, unquote, openly calling for reclaiming the positive side of the Nazi movement. Not only does Barrow appeal to a mystical Germanist spirituality like the Völkisch ideologies of the 1920s, he even sees the need for a green Adolf, unquote, who will lead Germans out of their own folk depths, unquote, and into ecological salvation, unquote. Barrow originally became well known as the author of The Alternative in Eastern Europe, which he wrote during the 1970s when he was a dissident Marxist and party member in the former East Germany. In 1977, the ruling communist government sentenced him to prison. In 1979, he was deported. Once arrived in what was then West Germany, Barrow became involved with the nascent German Greens, affirming that, quote, red and green go well together, unquote. In the early 1980s peace movement, he alarmed many by enunciating nationalistic arguments against the deployment of Pershing missiles. He began to speak less in political terms and more in religious terms, asking that, quote, the emphasis be shifted from politics and the question of power towards the cultural level to the prophetic level. Our aim has to be the reconstruction of God, unquote. He became a vocal fundamentalist critic of the Realo wing of the Greens, those who became generally committed to exercising parliamentary power, and ultimately left the Green Party in 1985. In a parting speech in Hamburg, he said there were structural similarities between the Greens and the Nazi movement that the Greens were not taking advantage of, but should. Then he gave his fundamentalist alternative, quote, "The other republic that we want will be an association of communities, of life communities in which God and Goddess are at the center," unquote. Barrow thereafter moved increasingly toward the New Age esoteric milieu. His major concern remained, quote, "the ecological crisis," unquote, whose deep structures, unquote, must be investigated, but he now thinks ecology, quote, has nothing to do with left and right, unquote. Today, Barrow is one of the leading spokespeople and the theorists of New Age ideas in the Federal Republic. The most important thing, he rambles, is that people take the path back and align themselves with the great equilibrium, with a capital G and a capital E, in the harmony between the human order and the Tao of life. I think the esoteric political theme of king and queen of the world is basically the question of how men and women are to comprehend and interact with each other in a spiritually comprehensive way. Whoever does not bring themselves to cooperate with the world government or Weltgeistung will get their due, unquote. And again, note as we proceed with this, the degree of overlap and many of the similarities to elements of, quote, progressive, unquote, thinking and politics in this country, the so-called New Age in particular. In 1989, Barrow co-founded a combination educational center and commune near Trier, the Lernwerkstatt, or Ecological Academy for One World, unquote, whose purpose is to synthesize spirituality and politics, again quoting, to come to a new personal and social orientation. It presents lectures, cultural events, and weekend workshops on various New Age themes, including deep ecology, ecofeminism, Zen Buddhism, holistic nutrition, Sufism, and the like, as well as German identity. His 1987 book, Logik der Rettung, marked an overt embrace of authoritarian theological concepts that shocked many former advisors. And skipping down, since the mid-1980s, Barrow has been remarkably open about proclaiming his embrace of the spiritual content of fascism for the salvation of nature and humanity. In The Logic of Salvation, he asks, quote, "Is there really no thought more reprehensible than a new 1933, that is, Hitler's rise to state power? But that is precisely what can save us. The ecology and peace movement is the first popular German movement since the Nazi movement. It must co-redeem Hitler. Indeed, quote, the Nazi movement was, among other things, an early reading of the ecology movement," unquote. Germans are to look for, quote, "the positive that may lie buried in the Nazi movement and reclaim it," he says, "because if we do not, we will remain cut off from our roots, the roots from which will grow that which will save us. Today, one must liberate the brown parts in the German character. The fact is," says Barrow, "that today there is a call in the depths of the Volk for a green Adolf," unquote. And in order to educate yourselves, I can't recommend a better way of doing it than getting a hold of this book, Ecofascism: Lessons from the German Experience, by Janet Beal and Peter Staudenmayer, published in softcover by the AK Press. It's a very short book. It's a good read, and it's important, an important read. Also, please utilize the Spitfire website and the linked websites. It's an entire mini-library of old anti-fascist books that will serve as a great basis for education. And don't neglect the websites by sister station WFMU, and also the For the Record supplemental section on the blogosphere, a huge and growing body of information with which to educate yourselves. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 629, It's Not Easy Being Green, Part 2, Ecofascism. This has been recorded on March 16th of 2008. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.